session number 25197.
I said earlier that the control of a substantial number of servants in a place like that was a difficult job for my mother. And I can give you an example of the sort of thing that I came across myself. When my youngest sister, who was then my youngest sister, Sylvia, was born in 1938 in Singapore, my mother realised, of course, that she needed a nursemaid, another Chinese person to look after her. And she asked the women who were then currently working in the household if they knew anybody. And a few days later, a young girl turned up. Now she was, I would have been 38, about getting on for six, I think. And she turned up. Now, this, in a way, illustrates what strong impression this place made upon me. I was very, very young. This girl turned up and my mother interviewed her in her own living room, in our living room. So, and I was sitting there. She was very young. She was only 13. And at the end of it, she didn't speak in English, but my mother had one of the other, this girl was the niece of one of the women there. And so the two of them were there, and the older one could speak English. And by that time, my mother had started to pick up a certain amount of Cantonese. I'm not going to say she spoke it, but she understood some of it. But she interviewed this girl, and it turned out the girl was only 13. Now, in those days, it was common in those places, as it was here, for the older girls in a family to look after the babies. So she had experience in looking after babies within her own family. But my mother came to the conclusion that she was too young and inexperienced to look after a newborn baby. So she said so, and said, unfortunately, we couldn't employ her, she couldn't employ her, and asked the her aunt to produce somebody a little bit older. We noticed the following day and the day after that the girl hadn't gone home. And I remember my mother remarking, you know, it seemed odd that she hadn't gone home. And she appeared to have lodged with the other servants in the compound there at the back of the house. And then one afternoon, I was playing in my playroom, which was at the back of the house and overlooked the servants' quarters. And I heard this terrible screaming. Now, I was very young. I looked out of the window and this girl was crouching on her knees, face down, on the ground in the servants' compound with a man who was, looking back at it, probably in his late 30s, perhaps, who in physical terms, a sumo wrestler, enormous man, and he was beating her with a stick of some sort. And she was screaming a hell of a lot. To me, as a child, it made no sense at all. Now, my father used to finish the office, as people did there in those days, at about 1 o'clock. And then he would come home for lunch, and my parents would have a siesta until about 4, and then he would go back to the office for another hour or two. And so they were in their bedroom, and I ran up the stairs. The playroom was on a mezzanine floor, so I ran up to the bedroom floor and hammered on the door, shouting to my father, "Come quickly!" And he jumped into his clothes and came running down. We both went down there. And he put a stop to it. and a minute or two later my mother appeared, and it turned out that this man was the girl's father. After a lot of negotiation and having to translate because they didn't speak any English, it turned out that he was beating her because she had disgraced the family in not getting the job. And that's why she hadn't gone home. My father, years later, when I was talking to him about it, was a bit more cynical. He said, well, I'm sure that was true, because this was very much a status thing in Singapore in those days, that, you know, to lose the job was to disgrace family. But he said, also, of course, he probably had half a dozen daughters, all of whom were in domestic service, and he would have been taking a part of their wages, and he had been deprived of that. And he probably was very... He said he was probably more angry about that than he was about the fact that she disgraced the family. But it was seen as a disgrace. Now, to European eyes, you see, that was a completely unexpected and almost inexplicable situation. You know, why beat your daughter after death because she hasn't got the job? You know? And this was the kind of thing they had to cope with quite frequently. And on another occasion, I think this was what this is the sort of thing that really angered my mother. I would have been about 8, and I had to go to the doctor for one reason or another, and we were registered with 2 European doctors who had a practice in one of the buildings just on Russell. What am I trying to think of? The famous square in the centre of Singapore, Raffles Square. And one had to go in through the door and then up a long flight of, fairly long flight of stairs, the first floor, and then into the waiting room. And the 2 consulting rooms were on the window side. And there were various other service rooms as well. And we were sitting there one morning waiting to see our doctor, and I think there were only 2 other people in there from what I remember. And the door opened on our left, and in came a very beautiful young woman. Even at 8, I could see that she was magnificent. Chinese woman. In retrospect, I don't suppose she was more than about 20, 21 perhaps. And she was flanked on either side by an armour. We used to refer to them as black and whites because they used to wear a white jacket and black trousers, cotton trousers, and either shoes or clogs. And she had one of these women either side of her, and she walked very slowly and painfully with pigeon steps past us and sat down on the chairs on the right, because the room was lined with a series of chairs on 3 sides. And I could see that my mother was furious, and I couldn't understand why. And this girl was very obviously from a very wealthy family. She was dressed in the most magnificent silk. I think it was called chamsong, a tubular dress, the Chinese, very, very Chinese thing. In fact, I think they're worn even today, with a split down the side, and embroidered with flowers and a magnificent thing. And she had black hair, of course, drawn back in a bun. And some jewellery, and she was, it was obvious even to me that she was very wealthy. And she had these silk embroidered shoes, but her feet were only about half as long as they should have been. And of course, in my boy's way, you see, I dug my elbow to my mother's side and said, hey, you know, in a sort of very loud whisper, what's the matter with her? My mother gave me this eagle glance. She said, silence. Was silent. And then as we saw the doctor and we would walk down the stairs and out, came into Raffles Square, she said to me, did you see her feet? And I said, yes, I thought they were rather funny. She said, yes, she's had her feet bound. And she said, she comes from a wealthy family where that practice has been going on for centuries. And she said, the reason for it is I didn't really understand the word status so much then, but she said, it's a status thing. She said, this is to indicate that she's so wealthy that she doesn't need to do any work and she is dependent all the time on servants. And she said that it's a barbaric practice. And she said it's been banned in this island for a long time. She said we banned this a long time ago, but she said they still do it.
Well, these are some very interesting cultural differences,
yes, yeah.
You know, and that fills in the background,
yes,
so well.
Yes.
But I think we ought to now go on to the war. But you did say there was something in your boarding school.
Yes, well, I went to...
Which relates to the war,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, that's right. I went to boarding school as a result of the incident that I described. And now that was a religious foundation, a French religious foundation. It was essentially a convent, I suppose one would say. But they had a lot of lay staff as well. And it was run by French... I can't remember the order.
What's it called, the school?
The Pensionnat Notre Dame. I can't remember the order, but the nuns wore... A rather unusual headdress, which was rather like a roof. I did know, but unfortunately I've forgotten. And there was a small contingent of monks who used to take the services in the chapel. And I went there. I was there probably about 18 months, I suppose, all told. And then the war came along. I can't say I enjoyed boarding school. I didn't like being away from my home. And I was most unfortunate just towards the end of the Christmas term, first Christmas term, I got chicken pox. And I had to stay at school all through the Christmas holidays until, I think, the last week. And the holiday was about 2.5 weeks, you know, and I was allowed to go home. I was taken home to Singapore for about 3 days or something, 4 days, and then back to school again. That was a terribly depressing thing. I really did feel awful, you know. The prospect of being at school for a term, all through the holidays, and then the following term, you know. And my parents they were not in the habit of coming up to the school. Because it was about 300 miles, 280 miles from Singapore in the Cameron Highlands. It's a long journey. And so they never came up there all the time I was there. But it was a good school, and the teaching standards were good. But I was bullied at first because the school was like most of the schools at that time. It took boys and girls up to the age of 12. From there, most of them came back to Britain or to their own respective countries for further education. I was small for my age at that time, and I got I was bullied rather a lot at first. I just had to learn to fight, you know, put up. Stand up for myself. In that sense, it was good. I learned to stand up for myself. But I didn't like it, of course. Some of the teaching was done in French, because the teachers were mostly French. So I picked up quite a lot of French at that stage, just simply by almost involuntarily. One had to learn it almost. It was that sort of situation. You know, they would speak in English, but they'd also speak in French. You know, and it was a good way of teaching it, I think. But as I was saying, I didn't really like boarding school, in actual fact. And my eldest sister was there too, for a shorter period, and I don't think she liked it either. Really, she tells me now, she looks back on it not without any real pleasure at all.
So you would have been there when the war started, when the things began to happen.
We were at Cameron Highlands when the Japanese invaded in 1941, yes. December 4th. The Japanese invasion of Malaya began on the 8th of December 1941. We were still at Cameron Highlands on that day.
Well, Had you heard about Pearl Harbor before then?
Yes, we knew about that.
Yes. What was what's the build up to this? Were you getting the feeling that some things might be happening? You know, you were a young child still. But I was wondering if, you know, there was any anxiety that was coming through, you know, before the end of 41.
Yes, I think as time wore on and it became obvious to people in Singapore and Malaya that the Japanese were going to do something, I think people began to, as I say, listening to my parents, you know, from time to time, I got the feeling that they were becoming very anxious indeed. In fact, so much so that my father was talking about going down to Australia. Although I should add there that he was committed to a three-year tour, you see. They finished their first three-year tour, and then he signed on for another three-year tour. Well, it wasn't easy to break these contracts. If one wanted to do that, one had to have a very good reason. And he did say to me after the war that the authorities there would not have accepted him going to them and saying, well, I think the Japanese are going to attack Malaya, and therefore I want to go home. They would not have been prepared to pay his passage, for one thing.
So he was really trapped?
In a sense, I think they were. They felt that they really had to, and also because of the sort of man he was, he had a sense of obligation. He'd taken on a contract, he wanted to finish it. But at the same time, they were becoming, I could see that they were becoming anxious about this. And also, one thing that did emerge was that there was a certain anxiety building up among the staff at the school.
Did you feel this yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Could you?
Yes, I was aware of it. Yeah. Although they, as responsible adults, I think they tried to, what should I say, not hide it, but play it down. The problem was, of course, that many of the children, some of the children, came from embassies, you see. And they were older than I was. They were 11, some of them. And they were old enough to understand the things that they had heard at home. And therefore, it was getting around to some of the younger pupils that, you know, things weren't quite right. And we were asking questions. I can remember asking a question, being told, well, don't worry about it. But I didn't understand was, why was my father suddenly talking about going to Australia, you see? Because I couldn't see any reason why he wanted to go to Australia at all. And I can remember this actually being discussed at the school. As indeed it was, because some of the other children's parents were also saying that they thought they would go to Australia. It wasn't just my parents. I think quite a lot of people were quietly planning to make an exit, you see. So that was really the background to it.
So could you tell me now about the events, you know, leading to your evacuation to Australia?
We were at the school. It was running normally. It was the 8th of December when the Japanese attacked. And the following day, we were told quite suddenly, we got up, we had breakfast, and we were told we were going home.
Had you, where you were in the Cameroon Highlands, were you out of the bombing? You know, would you?
Oh, yes.
You wouldn't have known anything that was going
not
on?
Not at all, no.
No.
There was no sign whatsoever.
No.
This is why we were rather surprised. We were told we were going home. And our trunks and bags were produced. They were packed. The buses appeared, as they would have done at the end of term, except that it wasn't the end of term. And we were very puzzled. All packed into the buses and taken down the mountain to the railhead at Tapa. That's T-A-P-A-H. Put on the train, sent down Singapore. Where bombing had started. And one of my first memories of that is I think it was the very first raid on Singapore, the 7th or the 8th of December, first Japanese bombing raid on Singapore left 60 people dead and 700 injured. This must have destroyed in a single night any lingering illusions as to the vulnerability of Singapore. And that that raid resulted in the destruction of some properties very close to where we were living, as a matter of fact. We lived up on River Valley Road is on the high ground above Singapore. Our house was what is called a split-leveled house, so that the living quarters were at road level, but the others were below or above. You know, it was a typical split-leveled house. You could see over the city. It was actually really, really very nice. But just down the road, literally, just down down River Valley Road, and probably no more than about a quarter of a mile away, a third of a mile away. I was taken by my armour to see the damage the following morning. And I remember seeing a child lying dead in the rubble. Yes, they hadn't cleared it. Bearing in mind that my armour was used to take me out very early in the morning. And yes, we were. That was when I became conscious of what was going on. But that first air, that air raid, and subsequent air raids, were really, I think, directed at the military and naval installations, and that sort of bombing of civilian establishments was. I'm not saying it was incidental. I'm not saying it was unintended, but it was almost incidental. What they were really going for was the dockyard and Salita Air Base and so on. But I can quite distinctly remember the first time we were woken up by my father came and woke us up, and he brought us downstairs with our armors, and there was a flight of stairs leading down to the garage, which was of course at the lower level, at the servants' quarters level. And as we passed the living room, I saw my mother on her knees praying. Well, she was so conscious of what had happened in 1937, you see. And as we went down the concrete stairs into the garage where the car was parked, we could actually feel the vibration of exploding bombs in the structure of the house. And then it went on like that until we left in the end of December.
What sort of preparations had been made for bombing?
Very few.
You know, were no shelters?
No blackout. The first air raid, the city was just a blaze of light. My father was asked to head a small contingent of Chinese air raid wardens. They did set up a system. And he became responsible for ensuring that blackout was set up in that area where we lived. But I can remember some very anxious conferences taking place in the mornings after the air raids, which became more intense, of course, as time went on.
Mm. Was there much destruction
Yes.
there that you yourself witnessed?
Yes, I did, because it was rather peculiar in the sense that people, I've noticed this before in other crises I've been involved in, people try to live as normally as they can, even though they can see that circumstances are undergoing a fundamental change. They carry on exactly as they have done before. And I have a book here on the shelf, Anthony Beevor's Berlin, The Downfall, 1945, in which he describes how German women in Berlin came out every morning onto the pavement, and they swept the pavement with brooms, as they had always done. Rumbling past them were Russian tanks, and on the other side of the road, buildings were collapsing under gunfire. But they came out, and they still swept the pavements. because they were trying to maintain normality. And that is what people do. And they did that in Singapore. People tried to live as far as they could normally. So my parents continued to take us to the swimming club in spite of what was going on. The thing I noticed was that fewer and fewer people were attending the swimming club. Each time we went there, there were fewer people there. And of course it made an impression on me. I realised that things weren't normal, you know, at all.
Were you yourself getting frightened?
Yes. I was beginning to be worried. The other thing we noticed too was that families we'd known for many years living there, fairly close to us, just down the road, suddenly disappeared. I can remember walking along the road intending to play with my playmates, you know, one particular morning, and they'd gone. House was shut up. They'd got out. Two of them were German families. How did they know? It was a question we were never able to answer.
Was there at this time any ethnic problem, you know, and troubles, movements against the Europeans? You were saying about the Japanese spies that had been in Singapore. I wonder if there was any sort of trouble whipped up.
I think you are probably aware of the difficulties that the British experienced in India when the Japanese were coming through Burma and preparing for an assault on India. Indian troops who were captured were turned round, some of them. I'm not saying that happened in Singapore because I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised to be told that it had in some cases. The Indians there were usually, as everywhere, they varied from wealthy shopkeepers, carpet dealers, people like that, many of them Sikhs, of course, to the Tamils, who had a tendency to be employed in the labouring jobs. And they lived in fairly primitive conditions, many of them. And I think perhaps they may have seen, and I'm really almost guessing here now, they may have seen this as an opportunity to perhaps change their circumstances, I don't know. But, yes, go on.
Derek Bartlett, end of reel three. Derek Bartlett, reel four.
I wasn't particularly aware as a boy of any immediate conflict, but I did have one very frightening experience which may throw some light on it. My father was arranging for us a passage out of Singapore at that point, and now we're looking at a period of perhaps a week before Christmas. He had to go down to the docks to collect some documents. And I asked him if I could go, and he agreed, so we went down there. We parked the car, and we walked up to the dock gates, and on either side of these, it was very Victorian, so the docks were Victorian, of course, built in Victorian times. And as with many such installations, they had these vast cast iron gates with a fence, you know, very, very, very Victorian thing. And either side there was a small building which acted as a kind of sentry box almost, but built in stone. And there were Sikh soldiers in each one. When we got there, I noticed that behind the dock gates, at a distance of about 20 feet perhaps, there was a line of Sikh troops, Indian Army Sikh troops, with their rifles at the ready. And the reason for that was that there was a vast mob of Indians, mainly Tamils, I would say, hammering on the dock gates, attempting to break them down. Now, my father hurried us to the sentry box on the left-hand side, knocked on the door opened, six soldiers standing there, explained what he wanted, and my father went in, and I was told I had to wait outside. And that was one of the most frightening experiences I had